Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip. I'm Glenn Moberg, and today we take Route 51 north toward Lake Superior and the Pinoki Hills of Iron and Ashland Counties, a beautiful natural area that is also mineral-rich, and therein lies the controversy. A proposal to create a giant iron mine by the Gogebic Taconite Company led to a fight pitting Governor Walker and his legislative leadership against the Senate Democrats and one Republican, who united to keep the state's mining laws from being rewritten and the mine from happening. The opponents said too much might be put at risk, clean water, trout streams, and a pristine wilderness area in exchange for high-paying jobs in an economically distressed corner of the state. The controversy led to some reflection, which led to the subject of today's Route 51 show, an environmental art, education, and history project called Pinoki Explore the Iron Hills. It opens June 23rd at the Northern Great Lakes Visitor Center south of Ashland. It's an exhibit which is the collaboration of 20 Northwoods visual artists, musicians, and writers. Our guest for the first half of the program, Terry Dalton, she's the exhibit coordinator, and also two of the artists involved in the project, the husband and wife team of poet and naturalist John Bates and weaver Mary Burns, both of Manitouish Waters. In the second half of the show, we'll be joined by another of the exhibit's artists, Anne Singsass. She's a painter from Stevens Point. Now, this is also the weekend for the 23rd annual Midwest Renewable Energy Fair in Custer, Wisconsin. That's just east of Stevens Point. And as we do every year on Route 51, we will devote a portion of our program to that event. At the bottom of the hour, we will catch up with Frances Moore LePay. She is the best-selling author of 18 books, including the groundbreaking Diet for a Small Planet. She is also Saturday's keynote speaker at the Energy Fair. Well, as always, we want to hear from you. We've got a full plate today, but there is room for you. Have you ever visited the Pinoki Hills? What do you think of them and their natural beauty? Do you agree with the decision to stop the iron mine, or do you think that the mine and the Pinoki Hills could coexist without damaging the environment? Give us a call. We'd love to hear your opinions at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Terry Dalton, as the exhibit coordinator, why don't you give us an overview of how the mining controversy helped in some ways lead to this exhibit on the Pinoki Hills?
Well, I think for many of us, it got us thinking about what are all the values of the Pinoki Hills, both the natural history and also some of the cultural things that attract us to the area. Many of us have been tromping around the Pinokis for a number of years. The artists are from Bayfield, Ashland, Iron, Vilas, Oneida, and even as far as Marathon County. And we all came together with the idea of maybe bringing some different views to the discussion, to kind of get people to think about what are all the values in the Pinokis. There are certainly mineral values, but there are also aesthetic values and other natural resources that are worthy of considering in the long-term discussion of what's a sustainable future for our area. And so, you know, the exhibit really isn't a yay or nay on the mining controversy. What it is an encouragement for people to learn more, and in particular, to get people to go out and explore the hills themselves.
Well, what exactly are you trying to accomplish? Is this a pure expression of art? Is it educational? Is it historical? Is it environmental? Or are there political components to it?
Well, it's a little bit of everything, with maybe not necessarily political, but we've got text panels that we worked very hard on with information about the history of the area and also the natural resources to give people an idea how big are these watersheds, what are some of the environmental concerns, what are some of the economic historical factors, what was the mining history of the area.
Mm-hmm.
But then the individual artists are making their own statements. Some of them might verge on the political, but many of them are just expressions of things that struck them as worthy of interpreting for the public. So it's got a little bit of history, a little bit of economy, a little bit of natural history and natural resources, but then also a lot about the heart and soul of people who live in the area and things that they think everyone should be thinking about as we consider the future.
Now, you've also got a number of supportive sponsors. You list them on your news release: UW Extension, the U.S. Forest Service, the Wisconsin Historical Society, the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission, and the Pinoki Education Project. So quite a number of folks from different organizations have helped you put this together.
Yes, and in fact, some of them have given us support as far as helping us, guiding us with the text writing. The Northern Great Lakes Visitor Center is a composite of partners at that research, at that center. So they have their home for the National Park Service, Forest uh-huh. Service, et cetera. So many of those partners are embedded in the Visitor Center themselves.
Well, if people go to see the exhibit in Ashland on June 23rd, what exactly will they see?
Well, on the 23rd, we're going to have an opening, so not only will they see the show, but they'll also get to hear some of the musicians play, hear some speakers, and some discussion from the artists. But what they'll see are sculptures, paintings, they'll be able to hear music, they'll read poetry, there are interpretive aspects of the show. They'll be able to pick up a piece of Iron County rock and test it with a magnet and figure out which ones have magnetism and which ones don't. They'll be able to explore different kinds of interpretive tools that help them get intimate with the subject. And they also can visit the mining exhibit, which is down in the Visitor Center. Part of their permanent exhibit has a whole area on historical mining.
So you're going to be looking at the history of mining with this exhibit, as well as looking at some of the natural and the environmental features of the Pinoki Hills.
Yes, yep.
And now, we understand that the exhibit already debuted in Madison, in the State Capitol Rotunda. How was it received there?
Well, we went down and set it up on June 1st and 2nd, and I was there over that first weekend. We had a lot of folks come through and a lot of really positive comments. Of course, I couldn't stay in Madison for the whole week, so I don't really know, you know, the total extent of visitation, but we had, when I took the show down last weekend, there were a lot of really great comments in the book, and many people were very pleased with it, who I talked to at the mm-hmm. show, happy to get the information and see the artwork.
Well, let's move on to our other two guests, one of whom has to leave us at the bottom of the hour. We've got the husband and wife team of John Bates and Mary Burns, both from Manitowash. Mary, you are a weaver.
I'm a fiber artist. Yes,
fiber artist. And John, you're a writer and a poet and a naturalist. And John, we understand you're going to be speaking at that kickoff event on June 23rd.
Yes, I am. I'm going to talk a little bit about values and ethics and trying to figure out that balance between economy, environment, community, all the complexity that goes into these kinds of issues.
What are you going to be telling the folks on the 23rd?
I don't know that I'll be telling anybody anything as much as just trying to frame how complicated these kinds of things are when you have value-laden issues that are in conflict. We all mm-hmm. want jobs. We all want clean air. We all want clean water. And how do we, when these seem to butt up against one another, how do we go about trying to come out with an appropriate decision? How do we as a community come together, as a series of communities, come together and try to make sense of it all? Because it's really difficult to do.
And Mary Burns, as a weaver, as a fiber artist, what are you contributing to the exhibit?
Well, the pieces that I wove for this exhibit, I wove on my jacquard loom, which is a loom where I can do highly detailed, very complex imaging. And I decided to work more from a historical perspective on my pieces for this show. And I've looked at the mining aspect and feature different pieces that are showing mining in mm-hmm. historical times.
So is this all on one particular work, or do you have a series of...
I have three pieces in the exhibit.
And each one shows a different part of the history of the area.
It does, different part of the mining history. In particular, one of the pieces is titled Timbering, and it's showing two miners in a mine shaft putting up log timber frames to support the shaft. And this was really dear to my heart because my grandfather was a logger in the area, and he supplied tamarack logs to the mines for this kind of work.
So you go back many generations in this area.
We do, yes.
And obviously, if your grandfather was a logger, you've got to have some sympathy from people who not only go out into the natural areas to appreciate them for their aesthetic and their natural beauty, but also people who make a living by harvesting the logs. And,
right.
And, you know, we've got a picture of miners on that state flag of ours.
That's right. It's part of our history, and I think we need to evaluate whether it should be part of our future.
1-800-780-9742 if you'd like to join the conversation about the Pinoki Hills, the site of that controversial iron mine, and now the subject of an interpretive art, education, and history project that will open in Ashland on June 23rd. 1-800-780-9742. Let's go to David in Ironwood. David, you're on Route 51. Hello, David.
Hello. I went to that meeting in Hurley about the mine. And I was pretty neutral when I went in, but after listening to the testimony, the people were put in the mine and just wanted to gut the environmental laws. And also, I heard, I think someone said that the estuary there is the world's largest freshwater estuary, and that the UN was thinking about making a purchase site of it.
Kind of a site, sir? You're breaking up a little bit.
Oh, I mean, the Bad River, where it enters into the Lake Superior, I think it's supposed to be the world's largest freshwater estuary.
And the UN was looking at giving it some sort of a designation?
Yes.
All right, David, thanks so much for the comments. And here we have someone who attended the meetings on the iron mine proposal, and he's saying, you know, maybe we shouldn't just change all of our mining regulations in order to benefit one project and one particular mining company. Any of you want to weigh in on that?
I'll jump in quickly. I attended the Hurley meeting as well. As to the estuary, the Bad River Kakagan sloughs are a national natural landmark designated by the U.S. Department of Interior. I don't believe that they are the largest coastal wetland in the world. They are considered one of the top, if not the best, coastal wetland in all of the Great Lakes. When I did my graduate work in environmental sciences, there was always said to me that this is the primo spot on the Great Lakes, the last great kind of legacy site for wetlands. So it's a truly important site, and thus is one of the keynotes in the whole topic of being at risk from leachate coming down off those hills. Yeah, it's an issue.
And now the Bad River watershed is particularly important to the Bad River tribe,
sure,
which lives downstream. Was there a feeling that tribal leaders weren't consulted enough when they were drawing up this mining proposal and drawing up the idea of changing the laws?
It was certainly the case at the meeting, from what they expressed, that they had not been brought into the conversation. What was most interesting to me at the Hurley event was the number of people who spoke favorably for the legislation, but when were brought into the discussion relative to specific pieces of legislation, would you be in favor of this or not, because it would it could potentially damage air or water. They weren't in favor of that. I never heard from anyone saying that they were willing to do the trade-off. It's okay if we damage water and air for the job. So I was encouraged by that. I think we're all just trying to find that balance, that that place where we do this as a model event. If we're going to do it at all, we want to be the best and bring all the science we can to bear to it, and all of the cultural history and all of the understanding, economic understandings we can, and do it right so that 50 years from now we can stand there proudly and not stand there sadly wondering why we didn't look at all the details.
1-800-780-9742 if you'd like to join the program on the Pinoki Hills. 1-800-780-9742. Let's go to Craig in Springstead. Craig, you're on Route 51 Regional Talk Radio.
Hey there. I just wanted to commend the organizers of this art show, and you know, and my biggest fear is that when this mine was in the news, this area is low on people's radar. I think a lot of people around the state don't know much about this area, and I would encourage the people to bring the show to Madison, bring it to Milwaukee, and get, you know, and environmentally conscious people around the state aware of and interested and invested in this area.
Terry Dalton.
Well, thanks for your comments, Craig. And I think that it's true. You know, when I was researching the text panels for this, I found a quote from Backpacker magazine that said that the Pinocchio Hills are probably the best kept backpacking secret in Wisconsin. And I think it's an area that's maybe underutilized by outdoor recreationists. One thing that we do have available is a website that we're encouraging people around the state to visit. And it's a WordPress website. It's pinocchiarts.wordpress.com. And we're actually asking people to go on there and add their own artistic expressions, add their own poetry, comment on their experiences in the Pinocchio Hills. So we're hoping that through the website we can bring other people into this discussion in a substantive way.
So you're actually asking the public to become involved in this ongoing art project. So it'll be an evolving sort of forum.
Right. Well, you know, when you think about it, why does anybody get excited about an issue like this project? It's because they have strong feelings. And whether your feelings are pro-mine or not necessarily pro-mine or sitting on the fence, or if you're just interested in some of the resources in the area, you have things to contribute. And that's what we want. We want people to get out there and discuss things with their neighbors. And by neighbors, I mean people not just from Iron, Ashland counties, but from around the state.
Craig, thanks so much for the phone call. We're going to take a quick break, and then Jim and Rhinelander will get to your call. I'm Glenn Mobrig. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio on the Ideas Network.
Support for WPR comes from Rely Local Wausau, working to build the local economy and strengthen the community by making local business everybody's business. Learn more about locally owned and operated businesses at relylocal.com.
I'm Glenn Mobrig. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. We're talking about a new art, education, and history exhibit on the Pinocchio Hills with the creator, with the coordinator, Terry Dalton, and also John Bates and Mary Burns, two of the artists who are involved. And we're taking your phone calls at 1-800-780-9742. Well, we seem to have lost Jim and Rhinelander. Jim, if you'd like to call us back, we'll try to get you on the air. Jim says, Terry, that he appreciates the educational aspects of the exhibit.
Well, great. And, you know, one thing I could mention, too, for folks who can't make the visitor center, we've put all the text panels with our information on our website so people can take a look at some of the background information that's involved with the show on that website. But, of course, it's a great experience to go up to the visitor center, especially this time of year, get a glimpse of Lake Superior and then take one of those hikes in the Pinocchios at the same time.
John Bates, you're a poet as well as a naturalist. Did you write a poem for this exhibit?
I did, and it was really a poem related to snow and spring and trying to take into account that any time one undertakes a huge endeavor, such as a mine or anything else on the landscape, you have to understand what the landscape does. Well, how does it work? And one of the things that occurs in the Pinocchios is there's 200 inches of snow, and there's a huge snow melt in the spring and fabulous rushing, crazy rapids on all the little streams heading down into Lake Superior. And that's one of the concerns environmentally is all that overburden and all those tailings and the potential of all that snow melt coming off of there. So I wrote a poem about that, if you'd like me to briefly.
I would love
do that.
To hear it.
All right. It's called Late April. Late April, when the sun's rays suddenly warm, the snow melt comes fast, and then we're awash in water. The little streams gorged, spilling over banks into the woods, the wetlands. A spring tsunami of water pulsing everywhere. The air saturates, too. Fogs drip every morning, so damp it's like wearing a wet rag all day. Then the frost goes out of the ground, and it's mud season, when everything slurries. Now little rivulets cascade everywhere throughout the hills, rushing onto Lake Superior, water spilling everywhere. Everything running down, down, all different sounds as the water rumbles over rocks and is a softness through the leaves. Forest, lake, river, all meet, mingling the mud and leaves and branches and stones, all in one pulse that will last into mid-May when the warblers and wildflowers will announce a halt to the trains of water and everything will settle in its new place, ready for the green-up, the transformation of sun, soil, and water into spring.
John Bates, who is the keynote speaker at the kickoff of Pinocchio Explore the Iron Hills, an exhibit that opens in Ashland at the Great Lakes Visitor Center, just south of Ashland, about 2 miles south. John Bates, a naturalist, who is here with his wife, Mary Burns, who is a weaver, who also contributed, as did 18 other artists and musicians to this exhibit. John and Mary, you obviously love the Pinoki Hills. Tell us what some of your favorite spots are.
Oh, Tyler Forks, I think, is probably my favorite. It's just a beautiful little spot.
Copper Falls State Park is just a little to the south there. I really like the Kakagan Sloughs. I've only been in there a couple times. They are a remarkable wild rice resource and fabulous birds.
What kind of birds can you find there? And why don't you describe the terrain for those of us who, I'm sure some who are listening don't know what a slough is.
A slough is a wetland complex. The Bad River's coming in and branching out, almost deltaing as such. If you can think of the Mississippi Delta, this is the Bad River Delta, as it were, going into Lake Superior. So it's flat. And all of these wetland species, in particular wild rice, an enormous acreage of extraordinary wild rice. And within that wild rice then are all the birds associated with wild rice, sorrel rails and, in the fall, kinds of ducks, wood ducks and ringneck ducks and herons and just a beautiful orchestration of all birds associated with water and that edge of water and land.
And Mary, what are some of your favorite memories of exploring the area with your husband, with John?
We do a lot of hikes in the area and beautiful spring flora. And John's poem kind of leads into how much water is an essence in the place. All these beautiful streams that are classified. I think we have at least 8 of the streams that run through this property are outstanding or exceptional water resources.
Trout streams?
Right. And we're not trout fisher people ourselves, but we certainly can appreciate people that do. And so the spring flora in particular is one of my favorite times to be out.
Now, John, one of the things about your poem, talking about all the water rushing down into the Bad River watershed during the spring snow melt and the rains, we have heard the people who have argued in favor of this mine saying this isn't like sulfide mining, where you're going to have all kinds of chemical wastes, that basically all you're doing is taking a huge shovel and digging up the rocks and digging up the material, and that we don't have to worry about the watershed the way we'd have to worry about iron sulfide mining or sulfide-related mining, which was a concern, of course, with the mine in Crandon. So isn't this just a big shovel? And if they're just digging up the rocks that are already there, what's the big deal about protecting the environment? It should be pretty straightforward. At least that's what the mine proponents are saying.
Sure, and I don't think it is straightforward, and I'm a great believer in science, and the more science we can throw at this, the better. We need to be able to model all of these streams in terms of their life over the course of a year and over many years, because we have drought years, we have wet years. How will these streams be affected when you dig a pit that's anywhere from a mile wide, half mile to a mile and a half wide, and 4 miles long, and maybe up to 22 miles long if all the phases are done. So there's going to be somewhere around 900 million tons of tailings and overburden stashed along the side of this mine. And all this rain and all this snow is going to filter through there, and down will come whatever materials out of that rock. My understanding, I'm no geologist, but in reading a lot of these materials, is there is a concern that there is some pyrite and some sulfide in some of the rock formation, and that could absolutely influence water below. Very simple.
John, I know you've got to go. I want to just grab one more phone call real quick before we take our next break, and we will go to Mark in Mellon. Mark, you're on Route 51 with John Bates, Mary Burns, and Terry Dalton. Hello, Mark.
Hey, how you doing today?
Doing well.
Enjoying the program immensely.
And I see on my computer, you told our phone screener that you moved to Wisconsin in 1978 and you live in the Pinoki Hills. Mark, how do you like where you call home?
Well, just absolutely fell in love with the area. I moved to Eau Claire in 78 and then kind of gravitated north, bought a little property up there, and hooked up with a guy named Martin Hansen, who was a great ecological person in the area, and he just taught me to love the Pinoki area, Superior, the rivers, the streams, and everything there. And with the mine coming in, kind of got involved with a couple of my buddies with the DNR, and we've expressed our enjoyment of the area so much. I'd hate to see something like the mine come in.
All right, very good. We'll leave it at that. Any of you want to add to what Mark just had to say?
Well, I'd just say that Martin Hansen was one of our fine old conservation gentlemen and did a lot for the area, and it's good to hear folks remember him.
Mark, Mark, thanks so much for the phone call. We really appreciate it. And John Bates, thanks for being with us for the first half of our program.
Thank you.
And we are going to have to say goodbye to John, who leaves us now for another engagement. Later in the show, we'll be joined by another of the artists in the project, Ann Singsass. She's a painter from Stevens Point. But first, we're going to take a short break and then change topics for just a few minutes. This is the weekend for the 23rd Annual Midwest Renewable Energy Fair in Custer, just east of Stevens Point. When we come back, we're going to talk to a very famous lady, Saturday's keynote speaker, Frances Moore LePay, best-selling author of 18 books, including the groundbreaking Diet for a Small Planet. I'm Glenn Moberg. You're listening to Route 51 Regional Talk Radio on the Ideas Network.
Support for WPR comes from UMR, a United Healthcare company providing employee benefits administration, integrated health management, and pharmacy benefits administration for self-funded employers throughout the U.S. More at umr.com.
I'm Glenn Moberg, and you are listening to Route 51 Regional Talk Radio on the Ideas Network. We'll return to our discussion about the Pinoki Hills in a few minutes. But right now, we're joined by Frances Moore LePay, Saturday's keynote speaker at this weekend's Midwest Renewable Energy Fair in Custer, Wisconsin. That's just east of Stevens Point. Frances Moore LePay is the best-selling author of 18 books, including the groundbreaking Diet for a Small Planet. She and her daughter, Anna, have also established the Small Planet Institute with the intention of spreading grassroots democracy across the world. Her latest book is titled EcoMind, Changing the Way We Think to Create the World We Want. Frances Moore LePay, thanks for joining us this afternoon on Route 51.
Thank you so much, and I love the Stevens Point area. I used to spend a lot of time there, so it's nice to be going back.
Well, what message are you going to bring to the Energy Fair on Saturday?
Well, the theme of EcoMind is that we create the world according to the ideas that we hold, and if our ideas aren't based in the evidence, we're in big trouble. And I'm suggesting that we're really trapped in an unnecessary, what I call, scarcity mind, that we absorb all sorts of ways, but the idea that there's not enough of anything, there's not enough goods, whether it be energy or food or anything else, and there's not enough goodness in us. And from that scarcity mind, we actually end up creating scarcity, the experience of scarcity. And I contrast that to the eco mind, which basically understands the world as science is now finding and you know, all sorts of evidence that the nature of life is connection, and that what we're doing now is creating scarcity, and we can stop doing that, and there's more than enough for all, so we can let go of the scarcity mind and recognize that in energy, for example, the sun supplies us 15,000 times a daily dose of energy compared to what we're currently using in fossil fuel. There is enough, more than enough.
The idea of basing your opinions on evidence and fact and science, even that seems to be contested in today's world. We have large numbers of people who don't believe in man-made climate change. We have people who don't believe in evolution. We have an internet and a talk radio culture where often facts and evidence themselves seem to be disputed by large numbers of people as if they don't matter.
And I think that reflects a fear mentality, really, when you just don't want to hear the truth because it's too scary. And I think we as environmentalists have a responsibility to make sure that we're not feeding the fear that causes people to close their ears. And so that's really what one of my themes is, that a lot of the messaging of well-meaning environmentalists can feed the fear. For example, the phrase, we've hit the limits of a finite planet, right? Oh,
right.
Gosh, we've hit the limits. Actually, no, what we've done is just create systems of waste. When you think about it, my issue, you know, has long been food, and we're currently feeding to animals a third of the world's grain, a third of the world's fish catch. There's more than enough for all. We can take a deep breath and get rid of that fear that I think blocks people from wanting to know the fact-based truth.
Mm-hmm. Is control of our food by giant multinational corporations part of this problem? Just four companies control three-quarters of the international grain trade. Just 10 corporations run by 138 people control half of U.S. food and beverage sales. And just three companies, Monsanto, DuPont, and Syngenta, control half of the proprietary seed market worldwide. Is this part of the problem?
It is. I mean, I think history shows us, and this is another theme of all of my life right now, is that, you know, we don't do well, we human beings, when power is concentrated. This is why I so believe in democracy. It makes my heart throb, even though a lot of people find it a yawn. But for me, democracy means the continuous dispersion of power, including in economic life. And so, yes, I totally agree that we can't have power concentrated in the hands of a few.
Realistically, how can activists and regular people change this situation, given the amount of money that the corporations have, to ensure that they maintain their control over the market?
Well, they control. They maintain that control by scaring us to believe there is no alternative. And so my life is showing where all over the world people are dispersing power by taking more themselves, whether it's in villages in India where people are rejecting genetically modified seeds and reestablishing their own seed banks and succeeding brilliantly, to communities here, and down to the dispersion of power in Organic Valley Co-op, which began there in your state, and you know, with a handful of farmers who said, you know, we can do this, and they've done it. It's a large part freeing ourselves from the belief system that tells us there is no other way than concentrated power.
What are you trying to accomplish with the Small Planet Institute, and tell us a little bit about it?
We want to help foment living democracy. Democracy not simply something done to us or for us, but what we ourselves are capable of as, you know, human beings. We didn't evolve to be couch potatoes and whiners and finger pointers. We evolved to be problem solvers. And this is a theme that cuts across every slice of the political spectrum, that it's not just pointing fingers at Wall Street or at corporate GMO giants. It's also ourselves taking responsibility.
Now, you've been described by Gourmet Magazine as among the 25 people, including Thomas Jefferson, Upton Sinclair, and Julia Child, whose work has changed the way America eats. And the book Diet for a Small Planet was selected as one of the 75 books by women whose words have changed the world. What's the reason for the impact of this book when you first wrote it back in the 70s and now after several updates and revisions?
I think it's really simple. The same reason I got so excited about it is that the idea that what we put into our mouths connects us to the earth, to each other, to our bodies, either for good or bad. That's power, and that's what people want, to feel that they count. And food connects us in these all of these ways and helps us let go of the scarcity scare. So I think for a lot of people, the book did for the reader what it did for me as the author, of allowed me to see the world in new light and to realize that every choice I make changes the world. In other words, in EcoMind, I say the only choice we don't have is whether to change the world, because every choice we make, and certainly the choice of what food we eat, who produced it, and its quality, and whether it's genetically modified, all of those choices we are making shape and put ripples out into the world.
Frances Moore LePay, thanks so much for being with us, and we're looking forward to seeing you on Saturday.
My great pleasure. Thank you.
Frances Moore LePay, author of Diet for a Small Planet, co-founder of the Small Planet Institute, Saturday's keynote speaker at the Midwest Renewable Energy Fair in Custer, Wisconsin, east of Stevens Point. That fair starts tomorrow, Friday. It runs through Sunday. Wisconsin Public Radio hosts Larry Mueller and Ben Marins will be doing their shows live from the fair tomorrow, and we invite you to stop by our Wisconsin Public Radio booth. Rick Ryer will be there tomorrow. I'll be there on Saturday, and Jane Ritger will be there on Sunday. You can find out more at MidwestRenew.org/energy fair. I'm Glenn Mobrig. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. We'll be back to resume our conversation about the Pinocchio Hills Environmental Art and Education Project right after these short messages.
Support for WPR comes from Northwind Renewable Energy in Stevens Point, partnering with agricultural and commercial industries to invest in central Wisconsin's renewable energy future. More about the benefits of solar for business at northwindre.com.
We are back on Route 51 Regional Talk Radio, resuming now our conversation about a new environmental art and history exhibit called Pinokie, Explore the Iron Hills, which will open up at the Northern Great Lakes Visitor Center south of Ashland on June 23rd. And we're joined again by exhibit coordinator Terry Dalton and also weaver and artist Mary Burns from Manitouish, and now by another of the 20 artists and writers who contributed to the project, Anne Singsass. She is a painter from Stevens Point. Anne, tell us a little bit about yourself and your work.
Well, as you said, I'm a painter, so I use oils and watercolors, and my work for this project involved looking at some of the factors that we were talking about earlier. What do people value in the Pinokie Hills, mm-hmm. aside from the monetary, aside from the minerals? So a couple of the works I've done are something that looks like a WPA poster, the modern version.
Okay.
So the Works Project Association, they put out all these posters of national parks, and they were sort of epic images of these national parks that made you want to visit the site. So even if you had never seen Utah before, seeing this poster made you want to see the place. I wanted to do something similar because so many people in our state have no idea where we're talking about when we see the Pinokie Hills. So some of the works are sites, Corrigan's Lookout, Upson Falls, Tyler Forks.
Those are all reflected in your paintings?
A lot of them are reflected in my paintings and the paintings of all the other artists involved.
So you have a personal attachment to the area. Tell us about that personal attachment. What does it mean to you? How often do you get up there and visit?
As often as possible. I like the area. I spent a lot of time up there when I was younger because I went to Girl Scout camp in the area. And I also worked there as a camp counselor for years. My parents own land in the area, and I am from Stevens Point, but it's deep in my heart to go to northern Wisconsin. I'm a lover of lakes and a lover of rivers and streams, and the Pinokie area has all of those things, particularly really good class trout streams and waterfalls galore.
Did you get involved in the mining controversy?
I don't know if I got involved in the mining controversy. I got quite an education because Terry talked to me about this when we were working on another project, and I knew a little bit about what was going on, but her asking me to maybe I wanted to be involved, I thought, well, I should be educated about this, and then I realized how many people in our state had no idea where this was, what was going on. So I got a bit of an education on the politics of it and also on the area itself.
Very, very good. What are your favorite spots? If you haven't had to name one or two.
Oh, I don't know if I get to, do I get to pick Tyler Forks again? Yes, okay, no.
All right, this has come up over and over again. What is Tyler Forks? I haven't been there.
Tyler Forks is, it's a small river. Would you call it a river, Terry?
Yes, it is.
Okay, it's technically a river. And it has small drops of waterfalls. It's heavily wooded. There's a tiny slot canyon, which it looks like something I want to get into. I want to put on my wading boots and go right in, of course. It has beautiful rocks all around it. It's full of wildlife, just chock full of birds. The bird song is incredible, echoing off the rocks.
And we got a call from one of our listeners, Jeff, who informs me that the Northern Great Lakes Visitor Center is west of Ashland, not south. It's actually south of Bayfield, correct?
That would be correct, yes.
All right, so I've been giving you the wrong directions.
But I think once you get to Ashland, you can find it. It's on Highway 2, just west of the T to Bayfield.
Terry, let's talk a little bit about the history of the Pinokies. And again, I want to encourage anyone who's been to the Pinokie Hills, who's listening to this show right now, who loves the area, to give us a call and share your experiences. 1-800-780-9742 is the phone number. That's 1-800-780-9742. Or maybe you're somebody who thinks that the mine should have gone in there, that mining is an important part of the history of northern Wisconsin, particularly in Iron County and Ashland County, and that the mine can exist in an environmentally safe way, bringing some much-needed jobs to a distressed area. Either way, we'd like to hear from you. 1-800-780-9742. And Terry, again, the history of the Pinokies.
Well, actually, it depends on how far back you want to go. We do have a couple tribal members, Native Americans, in our exhibit who are going to be speaking more towards the Native American connection to the landscape. But if you think about that, Native Americans have been harvesting and living in the Pinoki Hills for centuries. In fact, one of the other speakers at our visitor center opening is going to be tribal elder Joe Rose, who's going to talk about Native American uses of the land. But if you look at Europeans, probably the first noteworthy point of contact are, we actually highlight in our exhibit, and that's Whittlesey's early explorations, and he was actually one of the first geologists to explore the area. And he came through and did some phenomenal maps, which we actually have reproductions in the show of his original maps. And his reports went back to Congress, and shortly thereafter, some of the treaties with the Ojibwe came in, some of the agreements where mineral rights were transferred or attained by the federal government, and that sort of opened up the mining era, which was incredibly important in our region.
And this Charles Whittlesey, I'm pronouncing the name right?
Yes, Charles.
We'll just call him Charles.
Not Charles Wright, yeah.
He named the Pinoki Range itself in 1849, and Phil Kuchera, who's a member of your planning committee, he writes that he was raised in the Gugebic Iron Range when mines were still operating but declining. And he says during meetings in the area, he says he noticed that the name Charles Whittlesey often came up and that many people spoke in even reverential terms about him.
Well, you know, Whittlesey was quite a guy. If you think about what an earlier explorer would have been doing in the Pinoki Hills, trying to map these areas that had really not been explored by non-natives. And he did a lot of interesting things like naming places. For example, when we talk about Pinoki, there were several other names for it before that. He named it after the Native American term for iron, which is Powabic. But when his notes got to Washington, D.C., a typesetter misspelled them and wrote Pinoki instead. So, you know, spelling errors live with us to this day, and that's how they got the name Pinoki. But Whittlesey has wrote some just eloquent notes about the region, mm-hmm. natural resources that were there. And some of his maps, if you look at them, of the rivers like the Tyler's Fork, you know, maps in the waterfalls, and, you know, he thought they were pretty impressive. He had to get across them, of course. So they were difficult for him. So just really interesting historical information.
And Mary, your fiber art projects yes. detail the history of the area. What are some of the important historical aspects of the area that we haven't talked about yet?
Well, I think we haven't touched much on the logging, but we have talked a little bit about that. It was definitely an area that was heavily logged and continues to be logged to this day. Our timber industry is very important to us. So that kind of came in dovetailing with the mining.
One thing to keep in mind, too, is the historical mining was underground shaft mining, and the type of mining we're talking about now is open pit mining. It's a different kind of mining entirely. So when Mary talks about the logging, that went into suspending the logs to hold up the mine shafts. This type of mining would be a different entity.
Now, this is a huge mine they're talking about, 4 miles long, am I correct, and a mile wide and 1,000 feet deep?
The figures have varied a little bit depending on which proposal you're looking at. I think the last one that was up and running was talking about a 2 mile area.
How similar is this to mountaintop removal, the kind of thing that goes on in coal mining right now that's gotten so much negative press about absolutely defacing and destroying whole parts of the Appalachian landscape?
Well, in a way, I don't really know whether you could technically call it the same thing, but it would remove the top of the Pinoki Range in that area and deposit it elsewhere and remove the taconite that would be used. And the company that pulled out recently is a coal mining company who have done mountaintop removal. You know, one of the things to keep in mind is just because this one mining company has pulled out doesn't mean that other mining companies may not be interested and that we may get new mining bills coming in the future. So whether, you know, you look at the issue as it's not a done deal, we need to still be considering all the options and thinking about the future of the area in terms of long term, because that iron resource isn't going away.
I had a chance to talk to Governor Walker when he was in the Wausau area last week, and he said that he thinks he will be able to get mining legislation approved, even with a Democratic state Senate, because he'll be able to convince two or three of the Democrats to side with him. So this, at least from the governor's perspective, this is not a done deal. It's not dead. It's not over. And I think we can probably see an attempt to revisit mining legislation sometime in the near future. We haven't talked about the musicians that are going to be contributing, that are contributing to this project. And again, it's called it's called Pinocchio Hills Explore the Iron Range, debuting at the Northern Great Lakes Visitor Center on June 23rd. Here are two of the musicians involved, and we're going to listen to a composition right now. That's a little bit of a piece inspired by the Pinocchio Hills, and the musicians that we heard right there are Andy Noyes, he's playing the guitar from Washburn, and also Frank Montano from Red Cliff, who plays the Native American flute. Terry, is he a part of the Red Cliff tribe?
Yes, he is, and Frank is, I believe, a tribal elder, and is very well known for his flute playing around the region, maybe even nationally. So we're really lucky to have him involved with the project. And he and Andy are doing this a collaborative piece, which you just heard a little snippet of. Andy's been playing guitar, also involved, I believe, with the Big Top Chautauqua off and on over the years. So we're really glad to have them. They're going to be playing at our opening, so that'll be kind of a treat to hear the sound of the music in person. And then during the exhibition, their music will be available to people who are going through the show through the months while it's there at the Visitor Center.
Mm-hmm. And Singsess, this project has inspired so many artists. You know, it's hard to imagine 20 different artists and creative people from northern Wisconsin just coming together on one project. What do you think made that possible?
First of all, I think it was Terry, but I think so many people have so much love for this area that just the hint that they could do something about it. And with artists, it is what they do. You're a radio broadcaster. You use your voice to make people think about issues. These are artists. This is what they do. And the fact that they were just given the glimpse of an opportunity to raise awareness of what's going mm-hmm. on and to have a voice in our legislation, they jumped.
You know, if I could say something, all of the artists are doing this gratis, and they've all put in an incredible amount of effort. This is really a team project, from the photographers and sculptors, we even have a jewelry maker who made jewelry out of the iron-bearing rocks, Polka Adams. It's just been really tremendous, and they've all been stepping up and helping with press releases and logistics.
You know, Terry, this is a theme for you. You were involved with a project called Paradise Lost, Climate Change in the North Woods, and another one called Drawing Water, Artists and Scientists Exploring Northern Lakes. What is this symbiotic relationship that you've got going between art and science? People often look at those as being two diametrically opposed parts of the human experience, but you bring them together, and this is the third time you've done it.
It's one of the things that makes sense to me. Maybe because I started out my career in biology and art, it's a way I personally can bring these things together. But if you think about it, the environmental activists who have really made a splash in the world have used the arts and humanities to communicate their message. Think about Aldo Leopold or Henry David Thoreau or even Jacques Cousteau. People use the arts.
Ansel Adams.
Yes. I mean, people use the arts to communicate. It's a very effective tool of getting past the data and the technical details and getting to the heart of the matter.
We are out of time. And we want to thank you so much, Terry Dalton, exhibit coordinator for Pinocchi, Explore the Iron Hills, which debuts at the Northern Great Lakes Visitor Center west of Ashland. Let me correct that, on June 23rd. We want to thank Terry and three of the artists involved in the exhibit who are here with us today. Ann Singsass, a painter from Stevens Point, Mary Burns, a weaver from Manitouish Waters, and her husband, John Bates, poet and naturalist, also from Manitouish Waters. Thanks also to Francis Moore LePay, author of Diet for a Small Planet, keynote speaker at the Midwest Renewable Energy Fair this weekend in Custer. And that is east of Stevens Point. A reminder, you can stop by our Wisconsin Public Radio booth at the fair. I will be there on Saturday, Jane Ritger on Sunday, Rick Ryer on Friday. I'm Glenn Moberg of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks to our executive producer, Rick Ryer, our on-air producer, Jane Ritger. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. Next week on Route 51, we are live at the Woodson Art Museum in Wausau for the kickoff of a new exhibit, Botanicals, Environmental Expressions in Art, broadcasting before a live audience. Thanks for riding along with us on Route 51 today. Forward, as we say in Wisconsin. And until next week, we're heading out of town.